Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is November 7th. Ooh, as I say that date out loud, I feel like I'm forgetting somebody's birthday. I'll have to check Facebook. Is it yours? Happy birthday. I made you this podcast. So what you're going to hear today is hour one of my recent interview on Red Ice Radio with Henrik Palmgren. And very excited about this. I already see some new people coming into the website, leaving comments, saying they heard about us on Red Ice Radio. So this could be a good thing. And the way they do their content, Henrik usually does two-hour interviews. The first hour goes into the, you know, podcast feed. And then the second hour goes into a subscriber-only section of the website. Not a bad idea, if you ask me. So I just want to be respectful of the way they put out their content, and hour two of this show will be in the AV Club, and you can probably check the site tomorrow. It should be up. I will throw a snip of that second hour at the very end of the show today, where we talk about the mainstream media and positive role models for young people. That'll be after new subscriber geography trivia. Couple of show-related news items. First one, this is the first test of the Behringer Composer Pro XL. I want to thank Peter Pastor again for purchasing this for us off our Amazon wish list. I'm going to be playing around with it over the next few days. I literally just plugged it in, put the settings where I think they need to be, and I'm trying it out. But already I can tell this is going to save me a lot of work in post-processing. After the audio is recorded, I have to do all kinds of things to it. Reduce the noise, even out the levels, maybe get rid of some plosives. Those are those popping P sounds. So we've streamlined the process, and that's good news. Second item, not good news. I actually have suffered my first show-related injury. Yep. And let me tell you about it. So I live in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I usually record the show in my bedroom. Why? Well, it's the only room in my place where I can control the bouncing around of sounds. It's a relatively small room. I'm able to cover the hardwood floors with carpet. I've been able to put up a good amount of acoustic foam in here. And, you know, it's an environment that I can control. The rest of the house, the ceilings are very high. It's all hardwood. It's very, very echoey. I experimented with other places, but this seemed to be the best. Now, I don't really live at my house. I do. I work here. It's basically my office. I sleep at my girlfriend's house. She lives about a mile away. In fact, I didn't even bring my bed here. When I moved, I brought it right to her house and put it in her bedroom. So there is a bed in my room here at the house I live, which is essentially an office. And I said, I've never slept in that bed. I'm going to get rid of it. And this room can become just a studio space. I can set up another desk, set up the other microphones, and we could even do live shows from here. Because, I mean, I could have Osborne over the way the room is set up now. But it's a small room, there's a bed in it, and we'd have to close the door. And that's fine under normal circumstances. I'm very comfortable being behind the closed doors of a small room, which has a bed, with another man. But Osborne is a politician now, and that kind of situation has scandal written all over it, doesn't it? Right? I mean, I picture us recording and then opening the door, and there's, you know, the press. So get that bed out of here, I say. Let's not go looking for trouble. So the other day, I was taking it apart, and it's a big, heavy metal frame bed. And I took the headboard off, and I was starting to work on the other end of the bed, the footboard end. And some effing how, the big headboard part fell and hit me right in the lower back. And I was really scared at first. I actually, when I got up, I thought I was paralyzed because I couldn't stand up. I thought I had injured my spine. Turns out it was the sciatic nerve. So I'm telling you all this because I'm looking to crowdsource a little bit. I'm in quite a bit of pain. This is actually the most pain I think I've ever been in my adult life. Now, it's fine when I'm sitting down, but when I try to stand up, oh boy, does that hurt. And sometimes walking or twisting. And this is really cramping my style, you know? Like, a big part of my life is obviously exercise. I'm not going to be able to do that while this persists. Romance, you know, that's affected a little bit by this as well, I have to say. So I'm definitely looking to heal quickly, and if you have any insights, you know, regarding the sciatic nerve injuries and recovery, Send me a message. I'd be happy to hear about it. Carlos actually came over yesterday. He's had issues with this, and he gave me some positions to lie in and some other suggestions, but I'd like to get as much information as possible. And some people are probably saying, well, you should really go to the doctor. Well, hey, you know, this ain't Canada. So I just thought I'd throw that out there. I don't think it'll affect the show. But again, if you have information, let me know. So that would be great. Thank you so much. And here we go. Hour one of Red Ice Radio with Henrik Palmgren. Full disclosure, very light editing job on this, on my end anyway, because I was actually working on a graphic design project while I was listening back to this. So I think I might be umming and aahing like a real goober in this one. And what's the lesson there for you? Don't multitask. I can't believe I still try to multitask, but I'm definitely getting a lot better. Oh, and a final note, I also cut out all the introductory Who Am I, What Is School Sucks podcast stuff, and we get right to Henrik's first question about intelligence. And if some of you already saw the video that I put up on YouTube, this portion lasts about 20 minutes if you wanted to skip beyond that. Thanks for listening, everybody. Take care.
Let's try to put the history of education in context a little bit. This is a huge story. Again, something you've been talking about for, you know, for years now. Mm-hmm. You know, same thing with other good people like over at Tragedy and Hope and whatnot, and really trying to get to the root and the core of, you know, what's been going on and how the education system, how schooling have changed over the years and whatnot. But one of the points I wanted to look at a little bit is, basically, to put it bluntly, you know, stupidity seems to be a growing epidemic right now. And there are some research suggesting that we're seeing a decline in the average IQ, you know, in the West at least. And, you know, one of the points here is, yes, we are importing an unprecedented amount of third world population into the West, which is contributing to these statistics somewhat, but it doesn't explain everything. And I think by just empirical, you know, viewing what's happening around you, you can see part of pop culture, part of how people behave, everything, that there is a general, in my view anyway, decline in you know, intelligence and how people, you know, behave and from manners and all these kinds of things. And let's kind of talk a little bit about how this might be connected, if it's true that there is a link between intelligence and education, and if so, if education has kind of, you know, by default, by design, if you will, gone down the drain. What's your thoughts on some of these points, Brett?
Well, first of all, on the question of whether people are getting dumber or smarter, you know, really from generation to generation, that's how most of these studies are framed. I'm really on the fence about that. And I think there's actually quite a bit of hot debate on that issue. But I really think to try and understand it better and make a decision, you know, the first question I would ask is, what do we mean by intelligence? Because, yep, you know, when I don't even think this requires like rose-colored glasses or me being overly optimistic, but when I look out at the world, it's not the movie Idiocracy out there. Are you familiar with that movie?
Oh, sure, certainly.
Yeah.
In some cases, I'd say it is. I'd actually argue that, but... Yeah. Not across the board, obviously. Yeah.
No, you know, people say that, but, you know, I observe people, it's not like if people haven't seen the movie Idiocracy, 500 years in the future, a guy who is like put in suspended state wakes up and only the stupid people have bread and the world is ridiculous. But when I look at the world and compare it to that movie, it's not people speaking unintelligibly, bumping into each other, and, you know, putting Gatorade in their plants. What I see is people making complex decisions at increasingly challenging jobs, decisions about their finances, their lifestyles, their diet, transportation, recreation, in a time where, you know, the options and possibilities can be really overwhelming. So I think our brains, by and large, actually have to work harder today. And really, in some ways, the available stimuli might be pushing some of those brains to their limits, you know, from Facebook to maybe the darker, more adult-oriented corners of the internet. You know, there's a lot of stimulation out there, and I think our brains are exercised more than, say, I know a lot of these studies are trying to make comparisons between now and 100 years ago. So I don't see, by and large, the world of Idiocracy, but... if we narrow the focus, right, to political discourse or historical awareness or how history applies to current events or people's attitudes about current events and politics, well, suddenly the world looks a lot more like like Idiocracy. And that's interesting. So again, that goes back to what do we mean by intelligence? I think that's something that needs to be unpacked a little bit. Are you familiar with James Flynn, the Flynn effect?
Yeah, I am actually. Can you recap that for our audience?
Yeah, James Flynn was he's still alive. He's old. He looks like he's about 150 years old, but he's sharp. He gave a TED Talk, and I think like in the 80s, he started trying to make these systematic connections in IQ studies. And really kind of comparing generation to generation. As far as I know, he was the first person who did that. And what he found was there was a substantial and sustained increase in multiple types of intelligence from about the 1930s to the present day. And most of what he looked at are two main categories of intelligence, one being fluid intelligence, which is essentially the ability to think logically and solve problems in new situations. The other type is crystallized intelligence, which is the ability to recall and then use, you know, skills, knowledge, experience that you already have. So basically more connected to memory. And to really make a decision about, you know, the Flynn effect, that IQ is going up versus, you know, the study that that you sent me, which I believe was done at a university, which suggests there's been like a 14-point drop in IQ mm-hmm. over the last century. Right. I would really want to know what adjustments were made. You know, I know that in some of Flynn's research, he said that if people of 100 years ago or around the year 1900, were tested against our norms, their average IQ would be 70. And if we were tested against their norms, we would all be geniuses. It would be like 130. And I have to think that because the brain, and I will preface this by saying I'm not a neurologist, but because the brain works like a muscle in some extent, we live in a more complex world, right? So there's variables like profession, you know, 100 years ago, or even in maybe the 1920s or 1930s, how many people were required to do some kind of knowledge work, you know? And right. And many professions have been expanded and upgraded. We've also had the emergence of free time. You know, that was something that 100 years, in 1900, especially, or if you want to go further back, like before the Industrial Revolution, who had free time? You know, imagine going up to like a farmer in the Midwest somewhere or anywhere in the world and in 1860 and being like, gosh, I'm so bored, you know?
Right.
I think the Industrial Revolution had a huge impact on that as people moved away from farm life. The average family size decreased. Right. And that means that not to make a teachers union argument here, but the parent to child ratio improved. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, would mean that the adults who were in many respects the teachers would have more time with each child, and the prevailing vocabulary in the house would be closer to an adult vocabulary. You know, if you have 9 children under 10 years old, what's the discourse in the house like? You know, so right. I think those are all factors. Are you familiar with the 9 types of intelligence?
No, I'm not.
Well, I mean, I think this is another way of looking at it, too, because a lot of these intelligence tests are heavy on some types of intelligence, but light on others. And I think that it's kind of making this profile of intelligent versus not intelligent, and I'm not really sure how accurate that is. Mm-hmm. But I can run through these really quickly.
Yeah, great.
Because I think this is really important too when we're talking about diversity in education and learner-driven, self-directed education. That instead of students trying to fit a mold, people who are interested in doing real education with young people could look at the strengths or needs of individuals. So there's naturalistic intelligence, which is basically sensitivity to the features of the natural world. There's musical intelligence, which would be things like, you know, discerning pitch, rhythm, tone, being able to recognize, create, or reproduce music. The third one is logical or mathematical intelligence, which is obviously, you know, calculation, quantification, and then on to things like, you know, propositions and hypotheses and considering them. It would even include like patterns, putting things, recognizing patterns, putting things into categories, establishing relationships. And then existential intelligence, which is a person's willingness and really the sensitivity and the thought to be able to tackle some of the deeper questions, pondering things like death or more complex or even darker subjects. The fifth one is emotional intelligence, which is just, interpersonal. So how do people understand and interact with others? And one that's related to that is intrapersonal intelligence, which is basically understanding, you know, one's thoughts and feelings in the context of a group of others. There's bodily or kinesthetic intelligence, which is essentially mind-body union. Linguistic intelligence, which is, you know, the ability to think in words, the competence somebody has to use language to express themselves. And the last one is spatial intelligence, which is, you know, essentially thinking in three dimensions, manipulating images, recognition, artistic skills would fall under that. Imagination is really often categorized under spatial intelligence. So that's a broader picture. And when we talk about conflicting studies trying to address the question of are people getting smarter or dumber, I would want to look at, you know, the whole battery of tests that they used. When I was teaching, a friend of mine was getting a master's degree in school psychology, and I served as a guinea pig a few times doing these IQ tests that there were adult versions and, you know, young people's versions. One was the Wechsler IQ test. So I felt like I took a whole bunch of these tests, and I felt like they were somewhat narrow when we consider the nine types of intelligence. So I think that, you know, school is hurting us in some ways, but by and large, I would have to say that we're getting smarter in spite of school. And the Flynn test or the Flynn findings suggest that people are doing better with things like classification, abstract thinking, and analogies, while there would be less progress in things like politics and history, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Another thing is that there's been huge increases in, according to these tests, in like the average vocabulary of a young person.
Right.
So, because of the increasing complexity of the world, I looked at one of the studies, and it said between the 50s and this decade, it's been almost a 20% increase in the amount of known vocabulary. Well, if it's only measuring school children, it's 4%, right? So as the world expands, you know, kids learn all of these new words and concepts, but when they're locked away in school, not much has changed.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Because we have this... Well, we have a couple. I mean, obviously, as you say, first of all, the IQ test is very, and there are different, you know, versions of this, what have you. But this is very, to a certain extent, limited to what we know, as you're, you know, citing these other kind of intelligences, if we can call them that, ways to measure this, basically. You know, and I know that exams are very different than intelligence tests, but we have these scenarios where they pulled up older exams by, let's say, an eighth grader. There's been different articles about this published throughout the years. You know, they bring one up from like 1912 or whatever, and kind of shows that it basically stumps the 21st century, you know, test takers, and they realize that, whoa, what's going on here? Have our general, you know, knowledge base gone down? Do we know less today? At the same time, it's true what you say. We know a lot more today about things that they didn't have a need to know, a clue about back in the 1912, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
But the overall picture there, in your view, as far as you've been able to tell, is there a drop in this, or is there an increase? Are we? I mean, I know it changes. You've already kind of specified that, so it's difficult to pin that down. But are you worried in terms of the direction of where we're going when we're looking at education, and then comparing that to how, you know, how smart people are basically today?
Yeah, a part of your question was the link between intelligence and education, right? So yep. Again, it comes back to what we already discussed very briefly. What is meant by education? I think that the current schooling system certainly prevents young people from realizing their potential, you know? And obviously, people can better leverage whatever natural intelligence they have, whether it's high on the scale or low, with the development of things like critical thinking skills, you know, intellectual self-defense, and really emotional intelligence, which seems to be so undervalued by the school experience. And because I really think that living is learning, I would have to say that people are capable of more, that they have more potential today because their brains are being exercised more by the increased complexity of life. And I think that, you know, I read that neurologists have said that if you autopsied a brain from like 100 years ago and one today, you might even see two different things, two different types of brains. For example, people back then, because they were understimulated compared to the amount of stimuli we have in the world today, their memories might have been better, right? The same way different athletes have different types of bodies, right? So the part of the brain that deals with memory is the hippocampus. So the 100-year-old brain could have a larger hippocampus simply because it wasn't being bombarded with as many inputs, you know? And we, especially through this is so true with school. I kind of was casually interviewing the students that I worked with for show research about, you know, like the lessons of things like vocabulary, like what were you taught and what do you remember? And what I found consistently is they have to jettison what seems like useless information. It's useless because I learned it in school and I can't figure out why any of this crap is important. So it just goes into the, you know, the nether regions of the brain. It's in there somewhere, but it's not recallable because it's not considered to be useful. So I think we have to kind of bat some of the stuff that's, you know, we want to have as memories maybe out of the way to deal with all the new stimuli. And we might have larger prefrontal lobes than people of 100 years did. But it's very difficult to give a definitive answer to that question. I would definitely say the brain is different. And what intelligence means is probably different in comparing people from both those times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. And of course, as the environment changes, we change our environment as we, you know, go in a certain direction. There's certain needs change, and like any muscle, right? They atrophy when you don't end up using it. And it doesn't mean that it's gone. It just means that we haven't exercised that particular muscle, but it could come back. But it's interesting to know that we are changing, and this might basically then be due to the stimuli and the environment that we find ourselves in. Now, that having been said, despite school then, or schooling, education, do you think we're going in a direction that, educational-wise, that actually inhibits or encourages, you know, in the way that we are changing, as it seems like, or is it there to, like, undermine it, as we've heard from people like Charlotte Isherbeat, what have you, the dumbing down of the educational system? Or is it helping to kind of encourage that and raise that up to a higher standard, a bigger, a greater level?
Well, I think, you know, just to, you mentioned Charlotte Isherbee, who wrote The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, and she was really critical of people, like the progressives, like John Dewey. And this was actually, you know, about 100 years ago when maybe some of these other IQ tests, these early intelligence tests were being done, that Dewey was hard at work at places like, you know, Columbia University. planning, as Iserby would characterize it, this utopian socialist future, they were thinking about education as the individual subsumed by the needs of society. You know, the individual under the needs of society. The individual is a piece in a machinery of society. While people like us might think about education more as an individual pursuit, you know? Yeah. And that totally changes all of the calculus as far as I'm concerned. Because you could see that, like, the other idea about what schooling should be, opening all kinds of doors to dark places, right? That they should be fit or molded into what society needs and, you know, who's going to determine that. I mean, when Dewey was doing all of this great progressive utopian work at Columbia University, he was being funded by people like the Rockefellers, right? Mm. So who are pretty Republican-y, you know, in most respects.
You think.
Yeah. The opposite side right. of the American political spectrum from somebody like John Dewey. But that systematization of society, they saw value in that. You mm-hmm. know, they all came together on the power of school for that. So I think that in many ways, considering, to just answer your question, what schooling, what education really is, school is a tremendous hindrance because that's not what it's for.
Right. Yeah. Well, I feel that we have new versions of the John Deweys of this world that are popping up. We have new agendas coming to the table about transforming these young kids. And for example, you know, I don't know if you heard anything specific about Sweden's educational, so-called educational system, but, you know, in what direction that is developing, where the main focus doesn't any longer seem to be educate. In fact, I mean, the decline for a while, Sweden did have a pretty okay schooling system, but the focus have now shifted to completely different set of priorities. For example, they indoctrinate and push, you know, political correctness on the issues. They are very obsessed with, you know, gender neutrality, and it becomes about all these behavioral aspects as opposed to just learning about the world around you. And I mean, I've heard plenty of this to go around in America as well. And they push very strange ideas on the kids and whatnot. So this seems to be kind of a constant fight where you have new ideas popping up that trying to kind of impose on the children, and it becomes kind of like a live laboratory experiment in a sense. They don't really know what this will do 10, 20 years down the line when these kids grow up and what they've learned, etc.
Yeah.
But what would you say about that in terms of, you know, some of the stuff that they're pushing on the kids these days? And if you have any other comments on, you know, what you've heard about Sweden potentially.
Sure. Oh, let me just point of clarification. Where are you? Is that where you are?
I'm in, right now I'm in South Carolina in the U.S., but we're traveling back and forth quite a bit. My wife is American, so right now I came back from Sweden just about a week ago, so I've been there for a while. So I go back and forth quite a bit.
So let me ask you this. Would you say what's showing up in the schools there is a symptom of the prevailing political attitudes in the country, like the attitudes of the people, or does it seem more like this is being forced on people against their will?
You're talking about the kids or the adults?
The adults. Mostly the parents. You know, like, right. I know those are the prevailing political attitudes, like socialism, 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 and nanny state. But do you think people want that? Is that popular there?
That's a really good question. And it's always difficult to try to get into the minds of a lot of people because, unfortunately, in Sweden, you have a lot of the sentiments are that you're usually quiet about it. They're not very vocal about their critique about these kinds of issues.
That doesn't surprise me.
Which is, of course, part of the educational system and all that, you know. But there's complacence there. There's like they don't really vocal. But I would think that at some point, I think that a lot of people would be critical against what's being pushed on their kids if they knew. That's the other thing. See, because a lot of people just hand off the kids to the school and they practically raise them now and they don't know what's going on. If they knew and if they could put that in context, I think that a lot of people actually would be critical of it. But having said that, there are a lot of people also that are for the kind of system that's pushed in Sweden. And I think that that's partially due to the fact that they've been raised under those conditions as well. They've become effectively good little soldiers for this kind of system, if you will.
Yeah, that was something I always found kind of perplexing in the arguments that I would have with people who are, you know, more left-wing in this country, and they really talk about Scandinavia and Western Europe like it's just absolutely amazing, that this is a paradise the U.S. has to replicate immediately. And the argument is that a majority of people are very happy with the political system. And it's a difficult, you know, utilitarian argument. And that argument usually prevails over any moral argument about self-ownership and property rights, which I'm guessing are in many respects, from what I've read about Scandinavian socialism, those things are kind of out the window. And there's this, you know, This difficult question too is like, it's this ongoing effort to save people from themselves and their circumstances. Mm-hmm. But when is this work finished, right? Because if you're using this force to build an enlightened, fair, utopian society, wouldn't that society need increasingly less government intervention? But I'm guessing year after year, it's more, you know?
Yeah.
So how do you know when it works? You sent me an article from the Wall Street Journal about this. I couldn't read it because I refused to pay the Wall Street Journal $12 to see their archives.
Mine was accessible for free, but there you go. Okay.
But I'm wondering if it was about Daniel Hammarberg. Is that the author you were mentioning?
No. This is, let me pull up his name here. And we, of course, had him on here a little bit. Oh, there you go. Now they've blocked it on my end, too. Give me one second here. Let me just find this.
Sure.
Because it's a really good one. It's about basically talking about the changing environment of the climate in Sweden, of how children are being raised and how the states have stepped into the picture here, and how they basically are raising a generation of kids that have no boundaries. They've actually basically managed to take over the power from the parents, because they're so afraid of what they think imposing anything on them. They can't touch them overall. But the author's name is David Eberhard, and he wrote about the kind of the security obsession, and of course how children have ended up in a position of running the parents' lives, basically.
That's interesting, because there's this other author. His name's Daniel Hammarberg, and he wrote, and he's Swedish. He wrote an article called, a book called "The Madhouse: A Critical Study of Swedish Society."
I recognize that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the story is anyway that what inspired him to pursue this, it might not have been the only reason, obviously, but it could have been a catalyst. He got a visit from some kind of state inspector who wanted to observe how he was treating his cats. a neighbor reported animal cruelty, right? Now, if you have to have a government office that deals with animal cruelty, and you've got a bunch of people sitting around doing paperwork and, playing solitaire or whatever, yeah, I mean, animal cruelty is serious. Get somebody out there to check on the cats once in a while. But the funny thing was, is that as I looked into it a little bit more, it says that citizens can be convicted of cruelty to animals if they don't spend like a set number of hours each day petting their cat. This is the kind of stuff that he's reporting in the book. But now that for somebody, you know, thousands of miles away might sound comical, but he also has this urgency about what's going on in Sweden because of the risk of expansion. And of course, in many ways, that's expanding not just in Europe, but here as well.
Yeah.
And he gives these warnings about how, you know, Swedish government officials and intellectuals are really on the march, like with the UN and other national or international agencies trying to push their views on things like, you know, who's really responsible for the raising of a child. You know, is it the family or the state, or things like gun control? You know, so they're on the march. And none of that, as far as what's going on in their schools, surprises me. Every country, Norway, Sweden, and Finland all adopted the Prussian system, so which is, very top-down, very authoritarian. So they all have the environment to make possible, I would think, whatever the ruling class desires. You know, I know that in Sweden, they wanted to expand the system beyond Prussia. They're like, basically what happened in the United States. Like, let's take the Prussian system and make it for everybody. So
yeah, exactly.
I think none of that. It's this kind of a detachment, right? Like people, seem happy once a generation or two goes by in a place like Sweden or Germany or the Soviet Union or maybe coming soon in the United States. People want what John Gatto described as the freedom from the need to make decisions.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, none of that really surprises me. That was kind of a rant. Was there a specific question there that I missed?
No, it's great. I just wanted to pick up on that actually, because, Daniel Hammarberg, he's right. I mean, I got to get him on the program. Come to think of it, I just did a quick search and I've been in on his site before. So I recognize it. I've been there a couple of times. And, what's weird about this is, of course, they're trying to achieve some kind of, I guess, scientifically objective view on what is the, it's very much about efficiency, and it doesn't really matter if it's good or going in a direction which is, encouraging, for example, the students or whatnot, but Sweden's and, the Nordic countries' obsession with having everything in a very scientific manner break down what is exactly what you need. It's kind of like the cat story you told me. It's like, mm-hmm. They've concluded that 25 pets on the cat every hour is ideal, and that's what you need to do. It's so absurd that you lose grip with what really is happening, and these people are not connected to reality whatsoever. And I fear with the banning of, for example, homeschooling in countries like Sweden and Germany. They're pushing very much to kind of a complete control, which is it's not full out tyranny in the sense that it's physically violent, but it's very much about, it's a kind of a psychological tyranny. But having said that, they can do things where they, for example, come into your home and inspect things and making sure that things are done in the right way. And there's plenty of cases in Sweden too, where they've basically come in and just, taking children from families and completely destroy their lives. So this is a tremendously worrying aspect, and I'm just fearing about how to get out of that before this spreads as a virus. Because just as you said, these I wouldn't be surprised if these kinds of attitudes and ideas are beginning to pop up in America and other parts of the world now as this system is being exported out as a way to control human beings.
Yeah, a soft and subtle, sustainable totalitarianism, right? Sustainable, yes, yes. Because it's soft and subtle, full spectrum dominance, right down to the cat petting, question. So, yeah, absolutely. I think that's a real threat, because sooner or later it backfires. And a less extreme example, I live in the state of New Hampshire. The state directly south of us is Massachusetts. So New Hampshire has, yes, more of a kind of live free or die. That's our state motto and libertarian reputation. Well, Massachusetts is very liberal. And I really don't think I'm just telling myself a story and seeing what I want to see. I think you can really see differences in behavior, and in social interactions in places where the government treats people more like its own children, Mm-hmm. You see people who don't want to solve problems. They just want to pick up the phone and call the authorities, right? They don't want to talk to their neighbors. They don't have any skill or practice in conflict de-escalation or resolution. So I think the more extreme that gets, the more it's going to backfire when you've got, and I'm not saying this is what Sweden is, but history, especially in the 20th century, certainly showed us what nations full of children looked like, adult children, exactly. People who needed to be managed. And, the end, it always ended badly.
Well, that is what Sweden is. You're absolutely right. I mean, that's the bottom line too. What the other author, David Eberhard, talks about it, basically the how people are incapable of dealing with any kind of conflict resolution and what type of adult this actually creates, and the very fact that this is the perfect cocktail for having the state take over any kind of becomes a control mechanism, and it becomes the preferred control mechanism by the people itself. In other words, now it becomes, to a certain extent, well, it has been imposed upon them, but it becomes voluntary, because these people run to the government. They run to a third party to hack these things for them because they are incapable of handling anything like this on their own.
Yeah.
I wanted to, and as a follow-up to that. I wanted to ask you a little bit. I think you spoke elsewhere about this in terms of bullying laws and things like that, that the school environment is creating this type of scenario too now, where, you know, children are no longer allowed to basically stand up to bullies on their own and learn to take care of their own problems. What do you think the long-term effects of something like that is if these kinds of policies continue?
Well, I think it's exactly what we've been talking about. And the lesson is really helplessness, isn't it? I don't want this to sound insensitive, but it's this kind of rape whistle problem solving. And I don't say that to obviously make light in any way of any of the desperation or panic associated with that situation. It's just like, if a bad situation is presented to you, who are you going to call to help, for help? Don't think for a second that you can, you know, deal with something like that yourself. And I was reminded of this story that a friend of mine told me about his daughter who was in middle school, and she was escorted out of an assembly for speaking up and being really adamant about the fact that a whistle is not a weapon of self-defense, you know, because that's what they were saying, carry a whistle and blow a whistle. And in the U.S. on Twitter recently, there was this big flare up about someone suggested, it was a woman actually, who suggested that instances of rape could be reduced if women learned how to defend themselves, you know, and this was outrageous, right? This was considered to be victim blaming, right? And the response was yep. Men should be taught not to rape. Well, the truth is that almost all people have been taught not to rape, but I think a majority of people who are sexually assaulted have shown an inability, whether it comes from a lack of knowledge or resources, to defend themselves from that. So what it's all about to me, whether we're talking about bullying or rape, it's contributing to this culture of victimization, right? It seems to be pretty in vogue, according to what I see a lot on Facebook and Twitter, to be somebody's victim right now. So yeah. I think that both of those are really negative aspects of the whole bullying, anti-bullying legislation thing. There's a book. It was written by a woman named Susan Porter. It's called Bully Nation, Why America's Approach to Childhood Aggression is Bad for Everyone. And what she suggests is that because there's all this reliance on the authorities, kids are essentially, especially kids who are bullied, are becoming like less resilient, right? If you have this happen to you, now you're labeled a victim. You are made to think of yourself as a victim. And if that's your mindset, if that's the lens through which you view the world, and that's that kind of becomes your comfort zone, you're probably going to be more likely to be victimized, you know? So I really think that, you know, taking it out of the realm of student responsibility and not just making it the school's responsibility, but with things like zero tolerance, making these things legal matters and really not having any discretion as to what's bullying versus something like horsing around, that's dangerous. And I think the really unfortunate aspect of the whole bullying debate in schools is the failure to examine root causes. You know, they want to put the here anyway. They want to put the spotlight on cyberbullying, like it's the Wild West of the online world, and we have to protect children from it. But where do most cyberbullying episodes begin? You know, they begin in school. And on my show years ago, when I first started talking about this, I realized that it was forced associations that were leading to people being bullied. Any situations or environments that people were forced to be in together. Where do we see like the worst social interactions? School, obviously. There's a lot of military hazing. At least that's a thing here, like putting soap in socks and hitting people with it while they're sleeping. And prison, you know? A lot of really negative social interactions that could be described as bullying going on in prison. Those are all places where people are forced to be together. You know, it's really sad. I had an experience. It was around 2008. I was working with a student. He was a middle school student, or maybe he was in ninth grade, very young, maybe 14 years old. And I had just done an initial consult with him and his family. And I went back a week later to meet with him for the first time, and he was dead. This was certainly pretty traumatic for me at the time to have it be, you know, that real. But I remember investing a lot of time thinking about this in the weeks that followed, like how much of, has this school experience in this school environment closed off the world to this person, that led to something like that happening. I mean, think about what a small part of life high school really is. But when you're locked in there 35 hours a week, it seems like that's it,
Yeah, so it's everything, yeah.
That person felt like that experience, that treatment, caused, I would say, by and large, by forced associations, was going to be the sum total of their life experience. And I've done a lot of shows on this, on School Sucks, because the solutions and the finger pointing, it's really frustrating, because like I said, it's neglecting the one root cause of the forced associations, but the whole function of the school environment essentially relies on one of the central elements of bullying, which is threat. Kids are threatened, yeah. Or else there's no like win-win negotiations. Now, I think teachers, like for the most part, and especially from my own experience, I think they want to have a healthy and respectful relationship with their students, because if they don't, it just makes their job so much harder. And there's certainly exceptions to that, but I think by and large, teachers want to have things go well, like socially, with respect to relationships with the students. But that whole relationship still exists within this context of a pretty unhealthy domination system. It's our way or else. And I think that the most timely example of how the domination of school poisons those student-teacher relationships is this zero-tolerance thing. Because yep. We're supposed to say, oh, well, the teachers are on the front lines of the war against bullying, but they are the ones who wind up doing the disciplinary actions that lead to the implementation of zero tolerance policies, which is essentially bullying. It's like a harsh, uncritical response to somebody else's behavior. So none of that is working. I think it's making everything worse. Even, and the schools are funded by threats. So they're missing some of the root causes here. But if they look at the root causes, the system kind of collapses, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. Exactly. And they're in the position of where they're right. And it's just now a matter for them to enforce that, But let's take a break here in a little bit, Brett. I want to obviously pick up and talk more about this. And I also want to just kind of chime in and agree with what you said about the, creation of these victim classes as well. We'll see if we can talk more about that in the second. But now it's like you can apply a kind of a class warfare in this scenario too, where you have all these victim classes, fighting for each other, and this has now become the one priority of trying to solve these situations. No one can be offended by anything whatsoever. You're in a world with a lot of different other people who have different intentions and wills and everything else. But it becomes all about creating this very controlled environment where nothing outside of the accepted perimeters can occur. And I think this is a huge mistake to make. And if we are to go down that road and try to enforce people on how they can live, what they should say, what they can't say, what they can think even, then this is going to be completely, we're just going to be unaware. We're going to devolve humanity and we're not going to be able to do anything right. But let's see if we can talk more about that in the second here. Tell us about your website, where people can find there. You've had a show running for a long time. Anything else you want to give out and plug or what have you, Brett, please go ahead and do that.
Sure. My website is schoolsucksproject.com. And we've kind of given up on the idea of internet website forums. So we have a group on Facebook that people can join, interact with other listeners, ask questions. They can just Google School Sucks Project or search Facebook for School Sucks Project and find us there. And we have a YouTube channel. The username is School Sucks Podcast. And my current YouTube project is working through a video series on John Taylor Gatto's book, The Underground History of American Education, just taking excerpts and turning them into 5 to 10 YouTube videos to hopefully expose more people, especially young people, to Gatto's work.
All right, great. Well, do check it out, schoolsucksproject.com. That's the main website. We'll have these links up and a lot of good stuff there. So do check it out. All right, thanks, Brett. Stay with us here. We'll take a short break and then we'll be Right back with more in a second.
New subscriber geography trivia. You just say a person's name and they tell a fact about where they live.
Teddy Roosevelt visited once for a cup of coffee. First up today, we have RDD, who is from Westbrook, Maine, hometown of Kevin Eastman, the co-creator of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Let me tell you about these guys. A fictional team of four teenage anthropomorphic turtles named after Renaissance artists who were trained by a rat in the art of ninjutsu. They battle everything from petty criminals to alien invaders. One night in the early 80s, Kevin Eastman and his friend Peter Laird were brainstorming, and the concept for the turtles arose from a drawing by Eastman that he intended as a joke. No shit. This happened in Dover, New Hampshire, by the way, not too far away from me. So the story is that they got some money together and published a single-issue comic that was intended as a parody of four of the most popular comic books in the early 1980s, the Daredevil, New Mutants, Cerebus, and Ronin. Merchandising began in 1986, and it took off from there. Moving on to Marshall and Emily B. from Nashville, Tennessee, birthplace of Goo Goos, the famous candy made of chocolate, caramel, marshmallows, and peanuts. Goo Goos. Goo Goos. Goo Goos. And when you think about Elvis Presley, you probably think about Memphis, right? Also in Tennessee. But Nashville has an Elvis story as well. Did you know that over 200 of Elvis's songs were recorded at RCA's historic Studio B on Music Row in downtown Nashville? Presidents Andrew Jackson and James Polk both lived in the Nashville area, and Teddy Roosevelt visited once for a cup of coffee where he supposedly coined the phrase good to the last drop at the Maxwell House Hotel. That is unverified. Legend has it that after he finished his cup, he went outside to wrestle a bear, but became strangely aroused during the incident, leading to the first known occurrence of man-bear sex involving a U.S. president. Also unverified. But go ahead and spread that around if you don't mind. Hate that guy. Moving along. Michael S., from Nashua, New Hampshire. It's about a half hour south of me. Man, there's a lot of great bands right around me. Jack Kerouac used to spend his summers in Nashua at his grandparents' home. Isn't that a nice story? And one of my favorite musical artists, Ray LaMontagne, also came from Nashua. In fact, lots of people live in Nashua, and they are lucky. The city was twice named the best place to live in America in annual surveys by Money Magazine, 1987 and 1997. I hope it's still nice there. I haven't been there in a month or so. But things looked okay then. And if we want to go all the way back to the 1840s, here's a weird one. The northern part of the city, which is today called French Hill, was called Nashville, like Nashville, Tennessee. You might remember Nashville, Tennessee from the last entry in new subscriber geography trivia. The southern part of the city was known as Nashua, after the Nashua Indians. This name conflict was reconciled in 1853, and the two sides joined together to charter the city of Nashua. And up next, we have David G. from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the hometown of 80s music legend, Donny Iris. Now, all of you might be saying, who the hell is Donny Iris? Well, listen to this. Yeah, it's been a long, long time for such a sight, Joe. Yeah! Pittsburgh is also known as the City of Bridges. It has more bridges than Venice, Italy, boasting more than 445 of them. And it's the home of the emoticon. You know that smiley face you use all the time online and in text messages? You will not even believe how far back this goes. 1980, it was created by Scott Fahlman, a computer scientist at Carnegie Mellon University. Good job, Scott. Smiley face.
New subscriber geography trivia.
What's your view on, let's say, positive role models, things like this? I had a little question about this for you as well, considering that pop culture is, pushed upon children and teenagers. It's very much, I see it as very much in anti-intellectualism, etc. It's the type of entertainment media that comes out of Hollywood. It pushes a lot of destructive behavior on children as well. And it's very difficult to isolate the kids from this type of environment. A lot of kids want to see that. They go to that. But do you have any suggestions in terms of how to kind of take back control of the culture and begin to insert some positive role models into that particular picture, specifically then targeting, towards children and teenagers so they can get some positive things back in their life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me ask you this, when you look at mainstream media or Hollywood or the things that young people are asked to embrace and look at as attractive, what do you find to be the most troubling?
It's the overall environment, I think, of it's kind of anti-intellectualism. It's all about the social status. I see promiscuity being pushed and, everything that is basically, I see it as corrosive, ultimately. It's things that have kids ending up in situation of control when it comes very much about what everyone else thinks about them, and it's very much about, kind of fitting in. At the same time, it's kind of a degeneracy within that to a certain extent. It's anything that is, let's say, traditional is going out the window for the sake of just, pushing the boundaries all the time. It's kind of, to a certain extent, revolutionary, if you will. And I just see that as really destructive on children that needs, positive, male and female role models in their life to begin to emulate, And when I look around, I don't see that anywhere in the popular media,
Yeah, it's kind of like, you're a hard shell seeking approval, right? With really nothing inside. You're just your exterior. Is that part of it?
Exactly. It's very much about you being too cool to bother about being bothered about anything. And your hardened exterior, but yet at the same time, which is the kind of bizarre situation about this, it's all about being liked by everyone else and fitting in as much as possible or being the popular one,
Yeah. I would like to see, I don't like, maybe the conservative language of parents need to take more control. I don't like that way of thinking about kids. And I know that's not what you're saying, but those are the best models that young people are going to have. And I think that from my own observations anyway, we're seeing a kind of an increasing disengagement from parents. I think it was a big change in my life as I remember when my mom had to go to work. Right. It wasn't the economy of the 80s anymore. Mm-hmm. And she had to get a job. And then I became a latchkey kid. And, being young and having two parents that are gone, and you get home from school and you need to decompress and, you start looking for trouble. It was right around the time I was in heaven. I was 13. Right. My mom got a job. So she was gone till 6. My dad was gone all the time. And we had just gotten cable. Right. MTV. And I would just come home from school. I would watch Yo MTV Raps. They had this show called The Grind, where these girls in bikinis would dance on the beach. And, I was a middle schooler. And I was does it get any better than this? And that was my window into the world, So that was unfortunate. And I think that having a lot of that is, I think, people wanting to kind of raise their status economically. I don't think all mothers needed to go to work. Obviously, there were other political pressures that encouraged women to go to work in the United States, feminism, and I don't care who stays home, whether it's the father or the mother, it doesn't matter to me at all. But it's nice that, especially when somebody is young and they're being schooled, that they would have that kind of positive, loving influence from one parent or the other. Mm-hmm, but many kids today don't. What we've seen really with the emergence of the technology that's so accessible for young people today through iPods or iPads or the internet, and still even, the expanding world of television, is a lot of parents are like, great, there you go. Look at how quiet they are in front of that thing, and disengaging even further because of that. I did a series recently on a Nathaniel Brandon book called The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. And it was a series for adults as much as it would be for teenagers. What are the attributes of a mentally healthy person? You know, the ability to live consciously, the ability to accept oneself, to take responsibility, to be assertive, to live with purpose and to live with integrity. Those are things that I would want to see modeled, you know, and there might be some parents who are good at a few of those things or all of those things, but they're living in this world where they like it's annoying to have parents model those things for young people,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, because those relationships are so distant. And school really, really pulls people apart because our families apart, you know, parents and children apart, because parents often, because they're busy with their own lives and gosh, they really, really just want to believe that school is about education and that their children are in good hands when they disappear for 35 hours a week, you know? So they want to believe that that's a positive experience. They people get very, very upset when I try to tell them otherwise. You know, but
yeah.
Because of that, they also are often put in these adversarial relationships with their children because they have to be enforcers for the school. You know, did you do your homework? It's 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, even though your circadian rhythms want you to wake up at 9, get out of bed. You know,
yeah,
that is how a day starts for many parents and children 180 days a year.
Yeah.
You know, and that's strains relationships. So, you know, it's really unfortunate that parents have to be enforcers for the school in that way. So I think it's hard because, it's that self-fulfilling thing. One generation of schooled people makes the next. So maybe there aren't a lot of parents practicing, you know, these six pillars of self-esteem or exercising their critical thinking skills or showing high levels of emotional intelligence. And I think that the people who are concerned about this are probably already making a conscious effort to do these things, to be engaged, to have positive, loving relationships, non-adversarial, win-win, you know, avoiding that kind of domination setup with their kids. So they don't need this information, you know, and that's kind of the trick, right? Like the people who do need it, most of them would not listen to this. So that's why I think another part of modeling is, you know, from adult to adult, you know, but that's harder today too, because communities are so disconnected. People don't know their neighbors. They don't interact with their neighbors. They don't trust anything beyond the end of their driveway, right? And that also affects, yeah. You know, how they treat their kids, the amount of faith that they put in their kids, the amount of responsibility that they put in their kids. So I don't see a lot, and I really, like, as I've answered this question, I've tried to like have in the back of my head some conception of positive role models that are available through the media, but I'm not coming up with much. And that's pretty disturbing,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, I saw the video that you guys did about Will Ferrell,
mm-hmm.
and that whole culture, and that's what's cool, you know?
Oh yeah, definitely.
So I would love to see more parents like asking, being, feeling comfortable, certainly not, you know, preventing young people from watching anything like that. Like, oh yeah, go watch Funny or Die, go see Anchorman 2, but then talking about it, you know, like, how was it? What did you learn?
Yeah.
that kind of thing, I think would be really valuable. And I would say that I, you know, I mean, at times didn't have the best relationships with my parents, but my father certainly was always expressed an interest in what I had to say and wasn't like judgmental about it. Well, oh, let me tell you how it really is. I remember being like really little and him like trying to explain certain aspects of like politics and Ronald Reagan to me that today I just don't regard those explanations as very good. But I would say that he did a good job expressing an interest in what I had to say and, you know, a curiosity in what I thought. And I would say that I benefited from that. I didn't get too much of it in school. I wouldn't say I got none of it in school, but, you know, I feel like maybe I had better models than some, you know? Certainly, if I had children, I would set out to do better than they did, as we all should from generation to generation. But yeah, it's a troubling question, Henrik. There are not a lot of positive role models in the entertainment media.
I know, and it's what I feel there is that it's shaping the environment. It's really the framework where a lot of young minds are looking now, because as we know, we're kind of hardwired, we're designed that way to observe our surroundings and learn from it and try to fit into that. It's just kind of a survival mechanism. It's understandable, right? But when we have adults that are themselves kind of disconnected from everything, they have never really examined their own, cultural roots, the philosophical discourse about life. There's not much there. It's kind of a shallowness all over to go around. So when the kids are, first of all, not encouraged even to think about those things, perhaps, or even, be in that type of environment, they go to the to television, the media, and movies and everything else. Music, shouldn't forget that. That's a huge part of it too. And then they get, educated in that. They get that's how you should be, that's how you should behave and everything else. And I know it's obviously all kids don't develop like that. There's plenty of people who wake up, they see through that as they grow up, etc. But nonetheless, I think it creates a lot of it's a lot of work that you need to do for years and years to take yourself out of that and to kind of reset yourself from all the crap that you've been dragged through, basically. But my point here being, it's amazing that there isn't more concerted effort by adults either getting together and organizing or even doing it on their own. And maybe there are more people doing it on their own that I know, but of really trying to take back that influence for young people. I know that, the Christian community is doing that, right? They don't allow their young to look at some of the pop culture stuff. And I definitely understand that, although that to a certain degree then also creates a kind of an isolation, if you will. But there has to be something there, has to be a will there of taking control of where, our children's life is developing, don't you think, Brett?
I don't think that there's anything, and I know this is not exactly what you're saying, but I don't think there's anything inherently dangerous about pop culture or, Fox News, right? And there's always this movement on the left, right? We need to protect everyone from the people who are trying to hurt them and corrupt them. And I think there's a lot of that on the right too, right? There's a lot of that in political action generally, right? But parents, I think, see television as just something separate, right? And I've tried to go over this with people, like the agenda behind the entertainment media, and the hidden messages in these films, in these television shows, the agendas that they push. And people think that's all just crazy talk, right? So that's just the boob tube, television. But rest assured, my child is okay because they're getting an education. They don't realize that it's a counterfeit education, that they're not learning critical thinking skills. If I had a child right now who was 14, now I know that if I was suddenly in this situation, for the emotions might come in and I would feel totally different. Differently. I know that's possible, but I would say that as long as they had a kind of intellectual and emotional self-defense, I wouldn't feel the need to shield them from anything. I would like them to watch Funny or Die and say, isn't it hilarious what a socialist Will Ferrell is and how he thinks that I'm an idiot that would just, eat this up because he's Will Ferrell. Ha ha, how silly,
No, I agree. Exactly. No, that's actually my point there. Yeah. We have to develop that. But I guess what I'm saying on top of it, it's not about just saying, no, don't watch the TV and isolate people from that. I guess it's just about, we have an awful lot of bad shit out there, excuse the lingo, but linguistics. But nonetheless, how about pulling together and trying to offer something which is, that kind of stands against that? That's kind of my point, more or less. It's there has to be will and desire there to create something which has, offer something different than what we have in the entertainment media. And I'm surprised we haven't seen more of that. That's my point.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a great time, right? Because it's getting easier and easier to do that, which is, sometimes I think about all of these realizations that I've had in the last, 5, 7, 8 years, right? Since I really started to embrace the ideas of liberty and form a consistent message, really organize what I wanted to say about schooling versus education. Imagine if that was me instead of 2006. Imagine if that was me in 1986. I'd be screwed. You know, there'd be nowhere to go. There'd be no, you know, I could start a newsletter with a typewriter and put them in people's mailboxes.
Right. You know? Yeah.
So we are now at a point, and really from my experience, the time is now. And I just have this amazing feeling of gratitude that I realized all this stuff, that I embraced this philosophy, that I organized my thoughts at a time where I could do something about it, where I could share it with somebody. And that's possible now. So anybody who wants to do that is only a couple steps away from being able to do that. We have 11-year-old kids who have more YouTube subscribers than MSNBC. That's great, right? That's great, right? Because they're the gatekeepers, and they're becoming increasingly irrelevant. And I think people know it. So it would probably just have to look different, right? There's probably not going to be, in any way that I can see, and I don't mean to be a cynic, I just can't see how this would work, any real significant penetration of the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. It is what it is. It does what it's supposed to do. But now we have all of these workarounds for that. And I'd certainly like to be bigger. You know, last time I checked, my YouTube channel did have more subscribers than the official MSNBC channel. And it's not right. That many. But there are people who have huge audiences, you know, who are getting this message out there. And I mean, think about what it means to reach 100,000 people. And what did they turn around and do with it? I remember Harry Brown. Harry Brown was a libertarian candidate for president about a decade ago. And he said, never be afraid to talk about this stuff. Never be afraid to embarrass yourself. He didn't say this. I'm adding this. Don't be afraid to embarrass yourself, you know, getting up there and talking about, you know, the ideas of liberty or your thoughts on education or your criticisms of society, because you never know who's going to hear you and then what they're going to do. With that information, you know, I have I have a friend here in New Hampshire. He moved here for the Free State Project. He was a fan of my show. He lived in Texas and he loved School Sucks, and he used to work for Child Protective Services. You know, as he was after he became a libertarian, because he was holding out. As like that was the last hope, right? Like we have to at least they'll protect the children, right? At least they'll protect the children. And he quit that job and he started his own show, and he just published, as far as I know, like the first comprehensive book on the history and mission of Child Protective Services.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was his name again?
His name's Carlos Morales, and the title of the book is Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against Child Protective Services.
Oh, great.
Now, Carlos does not owe me all of his his success by any stretch of the imagination. You know, he's smart, he's driven, all that. But to see like somebody who said, oh, you know, I might have been motivated by the fact that, you know, I heard your show and I really liked it. And then we live in a world where like I was accessible to him, right? Just like, you know, the hosts of Free Talk Live or Stefan Molyneux at one point were accessible to me, you know, and they helped boost me in some ways. And I hope, you know, I can do that for other people who are motivated or inspired by anything that I've done. So I think that there's this great, you know, multiplying effect. If I can get this stuff out to 100,000 people, what can they do? You know, and even if, you know, 95,000 of them do nothing, you know, what do the other 5,000 do? What do 10 of them do? You know, it's exciting to think about.
It's still something, you know, and exactly. And they go on and they do things. And exactly. I mean, your point is well taken. The old media, the structure of that is definitely dying. It's happening. Things are transforming on that level. And what I'm talking about is, you know, in terms of trying to influence things in a good direction, that's obviously already happening, you know, and I think it's just more of a kind of a push of a recognition that's right. That's what we need to do. It's kind of a way of reassessing the objectives. Okay, what do we need to do here? What's going on? And I think a lot of people out there who are like, wait a minute, what can I do? What's going on? Where can I put my focus and attention to trying to improve things? And it's more you know, the encouragement there that there are tons of things you can do to get involved in, down to, you know, even, as I said, even making entertainment that have, you know, positive things in mind that are, you know, maybe not cheesy, but they're still, you know, it's just, it's a, and you can become, as you said, a YouTube success, if you will, you know, overnight practically these days. And the way to produce media is getting cheaper and cheaper all the time, and even effects wise. And there's tremendous things you can do these days. So I'm, on that note, very positive about where things is going. And I think if we can get more even concerted efforts towards actively trying to break down the power that the old media is holding, then I'm all for it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited to see like where this goes next. Like, it really feels like everything is moving in the right direction, you know? And obviously, like, the podcast market, you know this as well as I do, has become super crowded.
Sure.
You know?
It's saturated, yeah.
But I'm finding like more and more shows that are delivering similar messages in ways that like I'm excited about, that aren't boring, you know? Like, I think being able to be entertaining is really important. Like, that's how you get people to listen to you. And George Carlin said once, the point of laughter is the best place to insert a new idea. Mm-hmm. You know, you get people on your side a little bit. You warm up to them. I always say, and I didn't mean to get down on certain types of action, you know, but I always have thought that, like, politics is the worst place to introduce new ideas to people, because people go there to be angry and hostile.
Well, that's just it. That's my point. I mean, nothing, politics is a reflection. Well, I mean, not really, because we know it's hijacked, but nonetheless, this is how it used to be. It used to be a reflection of, you know, the desires that people have, what they want to have achieved. I mean, what I'm talking about in terms of entertainment media is that's the people who are controlling your dreams and your aspirations of what you want to become and who you are. And that's why it's so tremendously important, and also so tremendously dangerous in terms of who are you allowing to give you these inputs, you know what I mean? And what's their agenda, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that.